Hey there, podcast listeners. This is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCrit podcast. So today this is going to be a quick one because I'm getting ready for ASAP next week. One of the listeners wrote in requesting a show on critical hyperkalemia, and I figured that's an easy topic to knock off in a short amount of time. So this episode is based on an article by Lawrence Weisberg, and you could find it in Critical Care Medicine. It was in 2008, issue 36, page 3246. And I will, of course, put the link to this article in the show notes. Probably the best article on hyperkalemia for an emergency physician I have found. I learned some new stuff when I read it. And when I go back to it, I say, my gosh, this was really well done. All right, so you have a patient with hyperkalemia. You've made sure it's not spurious. It's not the result of a hemolyzed specimen. You got a value greater than probably 6.0 is when I start getting a little bit worried and want to treat these patients. What do you do? Well, the standard answer is you get an EKG. So that is the first myth to dispel, is when I was growing up in the emergency medicine world, I was always told if there's no EKG manifestations, you don't have to worry, and that there's this nice stepwise progression from no EKG to the peak T waves, and then the QRS widens. The P wave disappears, and then you get a sine wave EKG, and then V fib array systole. And that'd be wonderful if it was really true, but it's not. You could have a patient who has zero EKG manifestations, they could have a sky high K, and then all of a sudden they're in V fib array systole. And you should check the article for the references for all that, but it's been well reported that the classic stepwise progression is not necessarily true. That you could have a patient with some peak T waves and then boom, V-fib, or you could have a patient with no EKG manifestations, boom, V-fib, or you could have a patient with Ks of 9 and no EKG manifestations at all. And it's all patient dependent, and therefore the EKG is not the marker of how severe the patient is. Now, of course, if you do have EKG changes, that's even more impetus to treat the patient rapidly. Now, the article has a very nice table with all the treatment medications and their onset times, their duration, and I will reproduce that in the show notes as well. So the first question you have in treatment is membrane stabilization or not? And of course, the big membrane stabilizer, and we're talking cardiac membrane here, is calcium, which lets me go into my calcium rant for a second. There are two forms of calcium we use in the ED. There's calcium gluconate and calcium chloride, and they are not the same. They are very different medications. So calcium gluconate is a third of the calcium, free calcium, as calcium chloride. So 1 gram of calcium chloride is worth about 3 grams of calcium gluconate. Calcium gluconate has a big sugar moiety attached to it, the gluconate. If you give these kind of things rapidly, just like mannitol, the patient gets hypotensive. So you can never push calcium gluconate. It is always an infusion over about 10 minutes. Calcium gluconate requires liver breakdown to get the free calcium. So in a patient in shock, or a patient in cardiac arrest, or a patient with liver failure, it's going to be a delayed amount of time before that calcium is available. But because of this, it can be given in small crappy IVs, and if there's extravasation, it's not a bad thing. Calcium chloride, on the other hand, is more potent. It's 3 times as potent as the calcium gluconate. It can be given IV push, though if you do, you should probably push it slowly. And it doesn't need liver breakdown. It immediately disassociates the calcium and chloride when it hits the plasma. So now, knowing these two drugs, you can make some inroads as to when to use either of them. Non-emergent situations, crappy little 22-gauge in the hand, 10-minute infusion of calcium gluconate. You got to give more of it, so give 2 to 3 grams. But crashing patient, sine wave EKG, patients in shock, calcium chloride, IV push, slow IV push over a minute or two. If you have time, push it even slower. Better be using nice fat IV, preferably one in the antecubital space or a central line. Better make sure that IV is good. Maybe push a test dose to saline, make sure it's not blown. Calcium chloride extravasation is a bad, bad thing. So who do I give it to? Well, anyone with EKG changes at all. And then anyone with a high K without EKG changes, because we said you could go from no EKG changes to dead. So anyone probably beyond 7 is getting calcium. And really, when you think about it, there's probably no reason not to give anyone the calcium gluconate if they have a high K and you really think it's true. At least that's what this article would allude to. Another critical point with the calciums, they only last about 30 to 60 minutes. If it's been longer than that and the patient hasn't started eliminating their K yet because they weren't able to swallow the K exhalate or dialysis still hasn't arrived, you got to redose. And you got to keep checking EKGs on these folks and make sure they don't need more calcium. Now, I will tell you, the word in this article and from everything else I've seen is that calcium is supposed to work near instantly in about 1 to 2 minutes. I have seen patients that have taken longer to respond. And we're talking about the calcium chloride here. I've had patients that have taken 5-8 minutes. I don't understand why. It doesn't make much sense. And I used to say, well, you use calcium chloride as a diagnostic method because, you know, if the patient had a bradycardia and you pushed the calcium chloride and it didn't respond, then it wasn't from hyperkalemia. And we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end of the show. Now, I wait a little longer, and I usually will redose. I'll give a second amp of calcium chloride before I truly conclude it's not hyperkalemia causing the patient's problems. All right, you know the next stuff. Now we want to redistribute the potassium into the cell while we're trying to find ways to get it out of the patient's body. And of course, the classic drug for that is the insulin glucose mix. And that works really well, probably one of the more effective drugs for hyperkalemia. The dose is 10 units IV. Now, pretty much for every other purpose, unless you're going to be starting a drip, you should be given insulin as a subcutaneous injection. And I see people treating hyperglycemia with IV insulin without starting a drip. That makes no pharmacodynamic sense. But for this purpose, IV, you want rapid diminishment of the potassium levels. The way you give it, because it is such a small volume, what will happen is the nurse will grab a syringe, an insulin syringe, drop a fraction of a cc of insulin, and then push that into an IV port. That insulin's not going anywhere. That's just sitting there in the med port. What you want to do instead, and what you want to have your nurses doing if they're brand new, is grabbing a 10cc syringe, injecting the insulin into that, shaking it around like a cocktail mix, and then injecting that. And that way, more likelihood of insulin actually touching the patient's body. So along with your 10 units IV push insulin, you give dextrose to keep the patient from getting hypoglycemic. Now, it used to be for me, 10 units insulin, 1 amp of D50. I've been burned too many times with hypoglycemia after that. So now at this point, I usually give 2 amps of D50 unless the patient's sugar is already high. If the patient has a sugar greater than 350, 400, then you don't need to give any dextrose. Regardless of how much dextrose you give, you put an order in for a finger stick an hour afterwards. And hopefully this will keep you from having the embarrassing situation of the unconscious patient after their hyperkalemia treatment. Now the next drug, which very few people use, but it's a pretty good choice, is albuterol. As long as you don't mind your patient becoming a little tachycardic. And the deal with the albuterol is if you're going to give it, it's about 4 times the dose of what you use for an asthma patient. So asthma gets 5 milligrams. Dose they're recommending here is 20 milligrams. So if you're given the 2.5 or 5 milligram dose, don't expect to see much effect. Then there's the contentious issue of bicarb. When I was training, it was always advocated. Now a lot of articles, mostly review articles, are saying, you don't need to give it. It doesn't really do much. This article is very fair. It says, the studies that say it's instantly working are probably untrue. There probably is some effect, especially if the patient's acidotic. So I usually give it if the patient is acidotic. If they're not, I just skip it. Then there's elimination. I will give almost all of these patients Lasix. If they're fluid overloaded, I leave it there. If they're not, I give them some normal saline. And then we kind of get an exchange situation. They're peeing out potassium-laden urine. I'm giving them fresh potassium-free fluid. It's a good situation for all involved. anyone who could tolerate it, we're going to give the K-Exalate. I give 30 grams. Patients start pooping. They're not happy, but they're pooping out the potassium. And of course, the ultimate treatment, especially for your renal patients, is dialysis. Now, like I mentioned, if you're having trouble getting these patients to dialysis or getting those K-Exalate doses on board, you might have to repeat all of the drugs we mentioned, which means another round of calcium, another round of insulin, perhaps another round of albuterol. All right, let's end it with the truly critical situation. I have run into this problem not once, not twice, but I think at this point five times. Have a patient, complete heart block, profound bradycardia, we're about to float a transvenous pacemaker, and then the K comes back at 8.5. At this point, I do not even consider putting in a pacemaker in a patient with any potential for hyperkalemia, so any renal failure history, etc., without first giving 1 to 2 grams of calcium chloride. I just have seen this situation too many times. Not a sine wave EKG, not a classic peak T wave, just presenting with an AV block and profound bradycardia, which then turns out to be hyperkalemia. So the take-home main point I want to get across is profound bradycardia or heart block in a patient with potential hyperkalemia is hyperkalemia until you prove otherwise. All right, folks, I wanted to put in a plug for a new website by one of our faculty, David Newman, and a friend of mine on the blog world, Graham Walker. The site is called thennt.com. And what it is if you know what number needed to treat is, it's probably the simplest tool for understanding the true potential benefits and harms of any of the treatments we use in medicine. The NNT.com site is a free resource that uses this tool to best communicate the results of high-quality evidence. Now, I've been to this site. It is really useful because you could actually get a direct comparison of the treatments we use, and they review the underlying evidence. Some of the stuff's really surprising. A lot of the things we use in medicine have no high-quality evidence to recommend their use. So check it out. That site, again, is the THENNT, and that's one word, no spaces or anything between it, .com. And let me know what you think. All right, I'm getting ready for ASAP now. If you're coming, come find me. Say hello. I want to meet you. That's all for this week. Bye-bye.